So we're on Daf Tzadi Ches Amid Beis, and we're up to Tana Debei Rabbi Shmo, which is two lines up before the end of the Daf. And this Braisa that we're about to learn is going to explain different things about the Mishkan. Okay, first, Lema Mishkan Dome Le'isha Shemaleches Bishuk V'Shipuleha Mahalchin Achreha. So we're talking about, yesterday we spoke about the draping of the Mishkan. Mishkan means that tent covering that's directly on the Mishkan and how it drapes, and he gives it a comparison to a woman who travels, and there's a like a train that travels behind her. Apparently, you know, the garment was a little bit extended. Tana Rabbana, charutzim hayu krushim. Now, this braisa is addressing the relationship between the krushim and the adonim. In other words, how did the adonim exactly serve to hold on securely to the beams, to the krushim, in such a way that all the krushim were tsmudim, they were, you know, next to each other like a flat plane, and yet the sockets, these adonim, would hold securely the krushim? And the answer is that they made charitzim in the krushim. Now, a charitz, right, we know from Meleches Charisha, means to make furrows or indentations. So you take a look at the bottom of the keresh, which has to now fit into the adonim. I mean, each keresh into its adon. And what they did was they would cut out part of the bottom of the keresh in such a way that there were parts of the keresh that would protrude, and chalulim hayu adonim. On the other hand, the sockets, they would chisel it out and make openings, and it was a perfect fit. You know, every keresh had these two protrusions that would fit smoothly into the adonim, and that would secure it. And now we turn to Daf Tzadites Omer Aleph. And v'nirim krosim belulos kichochavim barakia. Now, at this point, the braisa takes a little bit of a digression and addresses some sort of beauty of the Mishkan, but now we're not talking about how the krushim fit into the adonim, but rather we're talking about how they created this covering over the Mishkan. Now, the covering over the Mishkan was made of many different materials, and we're going to see that in the next braisa. Of the Urios were made of Argoma and Talashoni, Sheish, etc., etc. We'll get into that in just a second. And the Urios were divided into 10, and each of the 10 had to be sewn in together. So we had is different, if you want to call them, panels of the Urios, of the spreading over the Mishkan. And they were sewn together into two sets. Each set had 5 panels. And towards the end of each set, in order to conjoin the two sets, they created loops. And through these loops, they put hooks. So you have the loops and the hooks. And here was the aesthetic beauty of the Mishkan. What you saw was a whole bunch of loops. The loops themselves were created from blue wool. And those were sewn at the end of each set of the five panels. And the hooks were made of gold. So imagine you have gold on the background of blue. Now look up at the sky, and you're going to see gold stars on the background of a blue sky. That's not exactly accurate, but if you follow what I mean. So the appearance of the Urios as they were attached one to the other, or more meticulously, we have to say that the five Urios were attached to another five Urios with these loops, and the loops were attached one to the other with hooks. The loops were made of blue wool, and the hooks were made of gold. And what you saw was the gold on the background of blue. That was, shall we say, Kikochavim Barakia. Torah Rabbanon. The Braisa goes into more detail about what were the materials and the colors therein of these Urios. So the Urios HaTachtonos, right, because there were two sets of coverings that we're talking about. There was the covering called the Mishkan. And then on top of that was the covering, the curtain that was made of goat hair. So now we're talking about the lower covering. And that was made of, number one, Tcheles, which was the blue wool that we spoke about before. And Argaman, which is a kind of reddish color, maybe a purplish color. Then Tolash Shani, that was even more reddish of a wool, that was a scarlet color. Sheish is linen. And the combination of all these different types of materials would make up the Urios. Again, we're talking about the Urios HaTachtonos that were directly on top of the Mishkan. And then we get to the Elyonos, right? That was the what we call the covering of the Ohel on top. And that was a little bit larger, as we discussed at great length yesterday. Now, we know that the Torah tells us that they were made of goat hair. But the Braisa wants to go a step further and speak about the concept of Nisan Liban, that the women who were wise women who were able to construct, you know, this, they were able to to weave these, these Urios together, they were very inspired. And especially with regard to the upper covering, which was made of goat hair. And they were able to achieve a feat that's amazing. Shel Maisa Izim. Again, they were made of goat hair. Again, this is the Ohel on top of the Mishkan. Ugdola Chachma Shenemer Belyonos. If you read the Psukim carefully, you will see a slight discrepancy in the description of the lady folk who made these two coverings. And there was a greater inspiration, a greater chachma to the upper covering than the lower covering. With regard to the lower covering, which we call the Mishkan, Ksiv, it says, V'chol isha chachma slev biyadeha tavu. Right, she took these various kinds of wools, and by hand she wove them. But with regard to the Elyonos, the pasuk says, "Kol anashim asher nasa liban osana bechachma," and it doesn't say biyadeha tavu, but it says tavu es ha'izim. Now that's a very strange phrase. If you translate it literally, they spun the goat. What does it mean to spin a goat? Obviously, they're spinning the hair of the goat. But why are they called Nisa'an Liban? Their hearts inspired them or prompted them. They were able to achieve an amazing feat. Everything that they did was on the back of the goats. You remember this. In other words, instead of first shearing the hair off the goat and then spinning it, they were able to wash the hair on the back of the goat, and then after it was bleached and it was white and clean, they were able to spin the tefillah, the spinning of the threads on the back of the goat. And it's only after the threads were spun that they would shear off these threads, and they were already manufactured. And Chazal understood that this took great inspiration, not only because it's complicated to manufacture such goat hair threads, but also because they anticipated a scientific phenomenon which you and I might not have known about. I certainly didn't know about. And that is that if you spin threads on the back of a live animal, in this case a goat, then it has a luster and a color that is absolutely stunning and long-lasting. And this is the inspiration of Nissan Liman. Now, Piderach HaDrush, I would just point out that this phrase, Nissan Liman, appears in two places. It appears here with regard to creating the covering, the oil over the Mishkan, and it appears in Hilchas Talmud Torah of the Rambam. And the Rambam speaks about the fact that you could fulfill your mitzvah Talmud Torah by setting aside a time period, a time interval by day, and another time interval by night. But Misha Nisal Libo, says the Rambam, his heart prompts him, he's inspired, is Lo Yasiach Daito L'Dvar Macherim. And then he goes on to quote the Mishnah in Avos, Paspa Mel Tochal, Mayim Bamisor Tishre, and basically he's full-time, singly focused on nothing but Torah study. That's the soul Levo, his heart prompts him. And Al Pi Drush, I would suggest, again, you know, everybody can dash in his own way, my Drush would be that the purpose of creating the Mishkan and the purpose of studying Torah is identical, and that is to have a close relationship with the Shekhinah. And it says in the Pasuk, the Asuli Migdash V'Shachanti B'Socham. And the Torah says, Isha She Yidvenu Libo Tikhu Es Trumasi, that they collected the contribution for building the Mishkan from someone whose heart prompted him. The Brisker Rav always used to say, based on this pasuk, there's no kfiyah. We normally have a principle called kofin ala mitzvahs. You know, if a person refuses to fulfill a mitzvah, we'll, pardon the expression, beat him blue in the black and blue, but not in the case of Trumas HaMishkan. Because HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, you want to make a Mishkan, does your heart prompt you to have that close relationship with Shekhinah? Then come forward with your contributions. And the same thing is in Torah. If you want to study Torah an hour in the morning, an hour at night, that's fine. You fulfill your mitzvah of Torah. The Gemara Nedarim says even Kriyat Shema Shachas V'Arvis would be enough. But if you're a person, says the Rambam, Shenisol Libo, he has this tremendous desire and craving to have a close relationship with the Shekhinah, then Lo Yasiach Daito L'Dvar Macher. Tanya Mishum Rabbi Nechemia, Shatuf Be'izim, V'Tavui Min Ha'izim. It means that they wash the hair of the goat on the goat's back, and they spun the threads for the oel while the hair was on the back of the goat. And now, we more or less completed our discussion about the Urios. Now we're going to go back to our discussion about the Agolos. If you remember, the Mishnah had said that there's a malacha called Moshit, and Moshit applies when an individual who was in one agola picked up a keresh, a beam, and he passed it on, stretching out his hands, to the person in the next agola, right? Each, there were two rows of agolos with two agolos on each side. And when the person in the front agola received the beam, he would then use that beam as part of the structure erecting the Mishkan. But the person who passed on the beam, he was in the outer agola, he was implementing what we call Moshit. But we require what's called Shtei Gustros Bidyuta Achas. Now, between one wagon and the other was a Rishus HaRabim, And each agola was a reshus hayochid. Moshit means that you take something from one reshus hayochid, you stretch your arm out over reshus harabim, and you hand it over to someone in a different reshus in another reshus hayochid. Did I get that right? Let me just say it one more time. You're standing in one reshus hayochid. That's one agola. You stretch your arm out to the agola that's on the same side of you, where the reshus harabim separates you and the other reshus hayochid. However, and we discussed this last week, there is no malacha of moshit going across a reshus harabim. In other words, if let's say you have a reshus hayochid here and you have a reshus hayochid there, so you have two houses that are on two sides of a reshus harabim that separates, that splits between the two houses, if you stretch out your arm from one house and give an object to the hands of someone in the other house, going over the reshus harabim, you're not chayav for moshit, because moshit requires duta achas. So that's what we discussed in the Mishnah. Amar Rav Mishum Rabbi Chiya, tachteyem ubeineyem reshus harabim, vitzideyem reshus harabim. As we discussed earlier on Daf Tzadi Zayin and Tzadi Ches, there are parts that surround the agola that are reshus harabim. And that's tachteyem. If you remember, Shmuel interprets tachteyem because there was no floor to the wagons, and there was airspace because they only needed, let's say, 3 amos out of the 5 amos for the three rows of krushim that were turned on their sides. Right, the krushim were 1.5 by 1 amma. So on that 1 amma, they tipped it over on the side, and therefore there was an amma between each of the rows. I mean, let's say, you know, between row number 3 and row number 2, there was an amma, and between row number 3, number 2, and row number 1, there was an amma of airspace, and that's where the reshus harabim was. Ubeineyem, right? Beineyem is the area between the agolos. So from one agola to the next agola was a reshus harabim, and then vitzideyem on their sides. Now this is a little bit more problematic, if you recall, because we came to the conclusion that the krushim were laid in such a way across the width of the agolos, and the protrusion was 2.5 amma on each side, and that would mean that both of the krushim of the agolos, from the right agola to the left agola, that kerish and that kerish, would touch each other. So the issue that we had about where is there a reshus harabim in tzideyem on the sides of the agola, that has to be taken under advisement, because lechora that's a case of reshus harabim makura. Omar Abaye bein agola lagola. So if we're going from one agola to the next agola, not to your left but in front, moving towards the Mishkan, kimelo orech agola, the space was equal to the length of an agola, v'kama orech agola chamesh amos. So each agola was 5 amos in length, and there was a 5 amma distance between one agola and the next. The only thing that I have problems with is, how were you able to stretch out your object over the airspace that's 5 amos? But that's not a question at all, because the krushim were 10 amos long. Okay. Now the Gemara says the following. Lumali, why did they have to have wagons that were so long, 5 amos long? That's a very long wagon. The arba upalga sagi, meaning no matter how you slice the cake, which I'll explain in a minute, the length of the agola would have sufficed. It was 4.5 amos. Okay, so let's go through two possibilities, and both of them will lead us to the same conclusion, that the length of the agola to surface to service the Krushim would have sufficed at 4.5. So let's go through the two possibilities, right? How exactly were the Krushim stacked up in piles? They were either stacked up on their sides, and that's 1.5 amma, or they were tipped over to the 1 amma side. So let's just figure it out. Right? If they were on the 1 amma side, right, if they were tipped over, then you could have, let's just think, if they're on the 1 amma side, then, just one second. Let me start the other way, which is a little easier for me. Let's say they're stacked on the flat side, which is wider, and that's 1.5 amma. So then the maximum number of rows that you could have would be 3 rows. Now, if you multiply 1.5 by 3, you get 4.5. So you don't have a need to justify the extra half an amma. Now, if they're stacked on the 1 amma side, so he says, I'm going to read to you this note. He says, either way, a length of 4.5 amas would have sufficed. If the length could accommodate three piles stacked on the 1.5 side, then all you would need is 4.5. It could also accommodate four piles stacked on the 1 amma side. Oh, I see. We need space for the rings of the bars. Okay. So the rings of the bars apparently protruded a half an amma. Okay. Okay, so those are the rings. The rings of the... They would somehow secure the bars, and they were a half an amma. But Kitzur, to make life easy for us, the maximum number we need in terms of space of the wagon is 4.5 amos. So Gemara answers, Ki hechi delo litchaku krushim. In other words, they didn't want to have too much of a tight space for the krushim. In other words, if you would press them together, then that might cause the krushim to perhaps be bent out of shape. So they wanted a certain distance, a little bit of a space between the krushim. They shouldn't be pressed too tightly together. Omar Rava, Tside Agola Kimelo Rochav Agola. So now we're talking about the sides of the wagons. And they equal the size of the wagon. Kamarocha Vagola. And what was the width of the wagon? We know the length of the wagon was 5 amos. What was the width of the amos? Shte amos umechza. So in other words, what you have here is shte amos umechza is the width of the agola. Now, on the side of the agola, on both sides, there were wheels, the galgalim. And that's called Tside Agola. And the total number here is going to be 5 amos. So if you're talking about the rochav of the agola, then what you're going to do is you're going to multiply the 1.5 for each of the sides of the wagon, which are the wheels of the wagon. Each wheel was 1.5. I'm sorry. Did I say 1.5? I meant 1.25. That's what I meant to say. So it's 1.25 amma each wheel, totaling 2.5 amma. And you add that to the width of the agola from one wheel to the next, and that's another 2.5 amma. And you end up with 5 amma. So the agola was, if you include the wheels, was all told 5 amos wide, and we said it was 5 amos long. So the Gemara asks, Lomali, Bi amsa upalga sagi. It would have been enough to have the width of 1.5 amos. Now, because the crushim were laid across the top of the agola, all you would need is a width of 2.5 amos. Now, you may say that they wanted to allow for the possibility of laying some of the boards lengthwise inside the wagons, then a width of 1.5 amos would have sufficed. So again, we're left with the question as to why the width of the wagon had to be 2.5 amos. It could have been 1.5 amos. And the Gemara answers, Ki hechi delo didadu crush him. In other words, you didn't want to leave too much space between the crushim, because then medadin means, you know, when you go back and forth, you put your right foot, and then your left foot, you know, what's it called? That's called medadin. Anyway. Ela dekaimelon derech rishus harabim, sheishes rei ama. We have halacha that was given through the tradition that the minimum width of a Rishus HaRavim has got to be 16 Amma. Is Anan de Gamrina Le Mi Mishkan, if we're learning and deriving Meleches Hotzah from the Mishkan, then we would expect that the Rishus HaRavim for Meleches Hotzah in the Mishkan would have been 16 Amma wide. And the Gemara asks, wait a second, the Mishkan Chamisre Hava, you could only get 15 amos wide. Why? Because there was one agol on the right, one agol on the left, there was a 5 amos distance between one wagon and the other. So if you multiply 5 times 3, you end up with 15. And that's the Rishus HaRavim. So the Gemara says, Amsa Yisera Havi. They had an extra Amma in the width. Dahavi Koi Ben Levi. And that extra Amma was so that a Levi could stand. Dechi Mishtalfe Krushim Havi Nokit Lehu. In other words, despite all the precautions that were taken to see to it that the crusher were not too squished, but then there was not too much space between them so that they would fall off, but nevertheless it was possible that the crusher would slide off. And therefore they appointed a Levi to stand somewhere in the width of Rishus HaRavim. They gave him an extra Amma for standing room in order to guarantee that if he would see one of the crushim sliding off, he would be able to catch it and hold on to it and re-secure it before it would fall. And hence, we end up with an extra Amma for the width of Rishus HaRavim, jacking it up from 15 to 16. So he writes the following. He says, a Levi would walk behind the wagon to watch for boards that might slide from the top of the pile and begin to fall into that Amma wide space between the rows of the crushing. If a Levi noticed that this was happening, he would run alongside the wheels and he would go to the Amma wide space between the rows as close to the wheels as possible, within a half Amma. He would set the slipping board straight. Now, what I'm curious about is, are we talking about monetary law, or are we talking about Kedusha? I'm not sure if I can answer that question. I don't see anything here on this. I'm inclined to think that it's halach of Kedusha, but I have no proof for this. It could be it's more of a material halach, you know, that the wood for the crushim was actually was actually carried by Bnei Yisrael out of Mitzrayim. Yaakov Avinu had already told his children to plant arazim trees, you know, back in Mitzrayim to take them for the building of the Mishkan. So maybe this was a limited supply, and that if one of the crushers got ruined, they made a big deal about that. It was very hard to replace it. I don't know. I don't see anything here. I was curious if it had to do with Kedusha. Like, for example, you remember the story of, what was his name, Uzziah? I forgot his name. At the time of David HaMelech, when the Aron was redeemed from the Plishtim. Do you remember that?
Uzzah.
What was his name?
Uzzah.
I'm sorry, Uzzah. And Uzzah actually perished at that catastrophic event, because what happened was he saw that the Aron was slipping off the wagon, and he grabbed onto the Aron, you know, with his bare hands. I don't know. Anyway, that's Aron. I don't know. I can't make any equation between Aron and Krushim, but I think it's logical that the Krushim had at least what we call a Kedushas Damim, and it has status of Hegdesh, and therefore we have to be very careful that the Krushim would not fall. But I don't know if you have to say that. You know, maybe you could just simply say that if it fell, it would, you know, it would cause cracks and breakage and so forth and so on. Okay, now we get to the Mishnah. Now this Mishnah is going to address the definition of a Rishus HaYochid. Let's just review what we know. A Rishus HaYochid is an area that has the width of minimum 4 tfachim square, and it has mechitzos that surround it that are a minimum of 10 tfachim tall. So that describes a more or less classic Rishus HaYochid. Our Mishnah is going to talk about a more original, you know, unusual kind of Rishus HaYochid, which is called a tail or a charitz. A tail being a mound that goes above the ground, and it's a very substantial mound. It has the dimensions of a Rishus HaYochid, and a subterranean below the ground surface Rishus HaYochid. In the case of a charitz, which again is a very serious ditch, you know, it has major dimensions to it. It's really interesting because a well, a bar mayim, I'm not saying always, but generally has the status of a rishus hayochid. And the reason for that is because a well has 4 tfachim square in its width. And it goes down below the ground by 10 tfachim. That makes the well a Rishus HaYochid. I mean, this creates major problems, because if you want to draw water from the well on Shabbos, then you're taking water out of Rishus HaYochid onto probably Rishus HaRabin. If it's not a Rishus HaRabin, it's at least a Carmelis. And the Jews were traveling through Eretz Yisrael to make Aliyah for Regel, and they needed water supplies, you know, how much water could they carry? And when they got to the well on the way to Yerushalayim, you know, how did they remove the water from the well, which is a Rishus HaYochid? I'm just giving you an example. And at that point, when they were traveling in en masse to Yerushalayim, the area outside the well had a status of a Rishus HaRabin. So how do you get the water out of the well? I mean, that's one case. Then you could have a mechitza that's half above ground and half below ground. So you could have 5 tfachim above ground and 5 tfachim below ground. Or let's say, for example, in the case of a sukkah, you could have a dofen ha-sukkah that's 9 tfachim. That's not good enough. But there's a principle called chokikin lahashlim, which means you could dig below the surface, you know, remove the surface level of a tefach's worth of ground space, and then you are mashlim the 10 tfachim, so you have a kosher mechitza of 10 tfachim high. Now, the Mishnah that we're about to learn begins to enumerate cases in which you're chayav, where the Rishus HaYachid is a little bit different, as we said. It's not your classic Rishus HaYachid where you have a house that has four machitzos that surrounds an area of four tefachim. So we have now Chulyas HaBar. Now the Chulya is the lip. I guess if you were talking in terms of a body of water, you would call it the shore, right? So the shore of the bar, that doesn't sound right. Anyway, S-H-O-R-E, I meant to say. So that's called a chulya. I mean, the Gemara doesn't know exactly why the Mishnah bothers to add the word chulya here. So that's going to be our subject for the Gemara. But the bar itself is a bar that's dug deep beneath the ground, and it has the depth of 10 tefachim and the width of 4 tefachim. And then we have Vasela. So you've got now a major boulder in the middle of Rishus HaRabim. And that boulder has the dimensions of 10 tefachim height and 4 tefachim square in its width. So the Sela itself is now a Rishus HaYachid. The Gemara, for example, in Erevin, speaks about a very common picture of municipal urban planning, I guess you'd say, where they used to have houses, and outside the houses there was a dumping ground. I guess you'd call it a rubbish pile. And the pile got as high as 10 tefachim, and after a whole week of people dumping all their rubbish in that pile, it had a width of 4 tefachim. And there were people that were standing in their homes, opening up their windows, and they were throwing rubbish onto the rubbish pile. And the Gemara accuses them of violating a chiyuv chatos hamelach d'orais of hatzah, because they picked up something in a rishus hayachid and threw it out into a rubbish pile, which is a rishus harabim. Shehein gvoim asara urechavon arba. So we've got 4 square tefachim and a height of 10 tefachim. Is a notel mehem, meaning he takes something out of the bar or the cella, and he places it down on the ground outside the bar or the cella, and that ground is Rishus HaRabim. Or alternatively, Anosein al Gabon, he picks up an object in Rishus HaRabim and places it on top of this giant boulder or into the bar. You know, this is a problem on Tashlich, right? So he wants to throw bread into the bar, and he might be Chayv HaChatos. But Pachos Mikan, if it doesn't have these two dimensions, if it's either less than 10 tefachim high or less than 4 by 4 tefachim wide, pot. So Gemara immediately asks, Lamalei lemisnei chulyas habar vasela. Lisnei habar vasela. Let's drop the word chulya. In other words, if the agenda here of the Tana of this Mishnah is to establish that you can't take out of the bar, or you can't put back into the bar because you can be chayav for that, then who cares? Why does the Mishnah feel compelled to add the word chulya sabar? And the Gemara says, "Misayeli Rab Yochanan, the Amar Rab Yochanan, bar vichulyasa." Mitztarfin liasora. Remember, we spoke about integrating subterranean with above ground to create this gova of 10 tefachim. So let's say the bar is only lamazogin 9 tefachim deep, but he's got a chulya on the bar. He's got a mound of earth that surrounds the bar on top, above surface level, as a kind of lip, and that's 1 tefach height. So he can add, I shouldn't say he can, but the halacha requires that we define this as a rishus hayachid, and we're going to integrate the 9 tefachim below ground of the bar, together with the one tefach above ground of the chulias habar. And therefore the Mishnah is telling me that the bar might indeed be Rishus HaRab. Rishus HaYoch, you're not allowed to take water out of this bar, even if it's less than 10 tefachim deep. Why? Because we're going to be mitzarev to chulia. And that's why the Mishnah added the word chulia. Tanya Nami Hachi. Now we have a braisa to support this conclusion. Bar Bishus HaRabim Amuka Asar Rechav Arba Ein Mimalin Heimena B'Shabbos. Now I'm not sure exactly what the Gemara saw in this braisa. So far, nothing. I mean, we'll see the end of the braisa in just a second, but at this point, I would have to submit to you the braisa is totally innocuous. It hasn't told us anything that we don't know. But now we're going to turn to the other side of this Amud Tzadik Tes Amud Beis to see the rest of the braisa. And this is the part of the braisa that really interests us. Elim Kain, Asu La Mechitza Gavoa Asorat Fachim. He's got to create, because again, he wants to take the water out of the bar on Shabbos. So in order to permit drawing water from the bar on Shabbos, he's got to create a mechitza of 10 tefachim. So imagine, let's say he wants to feed his animals, give drink to his animals, like Rachel gave to Eliezer, right? So he wants to have an area around the bar, which is Rishus HaYochid. So he creates within a certain radius that would allow him to bring in his cows, into that radius, into that area, a Rishus HaYochid. And how does he do so? By surrounding that area with mechitzos. And the minimum size, the height of a mechitza, has to be 10 tefachim. The ain't shosim emenu b'shabes elim kein hichnisla rosho verubo. Now, in order to drink from the well, he has to draw from a pail. So the pail is something that he has to lower into the bar, into the well. And if he didn't make this mechitza around the bar, then he's not going to be able to draw the water from the bar. Now, I said that he was trying to feed his animals. He's drinking giving drink to his animals. Forget about that. He wants the drink from the bar. He himself wants to drink from the bar. So now, he is bending his head into the bar. So now at that point, you and I would say that it should be mutter. Right? Let's say he dips his head into the halal habar. There's no mechitza around the bar, and he dips a cup into the bar, draws some water, and drinks the water while his head is inside the bar. On a Doraisa level, that would be perfectly permissible. However, the Braisa is telling us that Midrabbanan, this is Asur. And this is Xera, because we're afraid that even if he puts his head into the bar and drinks with his head into the bar, he might be tempted to straighten out his body. And lo and behold, the very moment that he straightens out his body, his feet are in a Rishus HaRabim. He has completed a Meleches Hotzah. However, under a certain condition, the Rabbanan will waive that gzera and allow him to drink from the bar without a machitza. And that's the case of Hichnis La Rosho Verubo. Now this is very similar to a Gemara in Sukkah, very famous Gemara. I think the Gemara is also, if I'm not mistaken, in Brachos, in Masechta Brachos, that if you have a table inside a sukkah, underneath the schach, and you're standing outside the sukkah, you're allowed to eat from that table that's inside the sukkah, even an achilas keva, if it's rosho verubo inside the sukkah. Again, Beit Shammai, you're not going to be happy about that, but we're okay with it. Why? Because a person is considered located not where his feet are, but where rosho verubo are. And he's nimshach achar rosho verubo. So again, if it's only rosho and he sticks his head inside the bar, then we're afraid, since most of his body is outside the bar, he will be nimshach achar rov gufo. And that would complete a maleches hotzah. If on the other hand, it's rosho verubo inside the bar, even though his feet are outside the bar, then whatever drinking he gets involved in inside the bar, with its rosho verubo inside the bar, we're not afraid that he's nimshach basar gufo and he's going to straighten himself out. And I believe that this is what's called a heker, which means that very often the Rabbanon, in a gzera situation, they will add a proviso, the goal of which is to remind you that we only allowed you this on the very strict, restricted conditions, so that you wouldn't take the liberty of perhaps violating a doraisa. So we add a certain shinui, or a heker. And if we say to the person, you're only allowed to drink from the bar, if it's rosho verubo inside the bar, I mean, there's no greater hecker than that. I mean, who would do such a thing? You know, if you ask me, I would say it's a safety issue. Imagine that rosho verubo is inside the bar. I don't even know how he's able to achieve this, but let's assume it's a very large bar. It's more than 4 tefachim wide. The punchline for our purposes of this brisa is the last 4 words of the brisa. Bar v'chulyasa mitztarfin le'asara. Which is exactly what we saw in the name of Rabbi Yochanan, that you could have something above the bar, that's above ground level, and that is attached to the bar to create the depth of 10 tefachim. We're going to integrate both the bar on top, or shall we call it the chulya sabar, and the bar on the bottom that's subterraneous. So we have 2 types of mechitzas. We have mechitzas that are 10 tefachim above and 10 tefachim below. And now we're going to say that definition of mechitza does not absolutely separate the 2 definitions. You could have an overlap of both mechitzos by integrating 5, let's say, tefachim above ground with 5 tefachim below ground. Boy mine Rav Mordechai mi Rava. Amud Birshusa Rabim Gavoa Asara Virachov Arba. So we're talking about a major pillar that is 10 tefachim high and is 4 tefachim wide. You know, when I was a kid, I'm sure we've mentioned this in the past, and you found yourself, well, we didn't have an Eruv. Could you imagine Flatbush without an Eruv? Okay, I'm really dating myself. But if you found that all of a sudden, you know, you got a tissue in your pocket or something, they would tell you to find a hydrant, a water hydrant. You know, put it on top. Why? Because the water hydrant is a makom p'tur, because it comes to a spitz, you know. But here he's got an amud that doesn't come to a spitz. It's wide. It's 4 tefachim. It's 4 tefachim wide. Zarek Mishasarab Menochal Gabov. Mau. So he throws something when he's standing over Sarab and it lands on top of this Amud. Now, I don't begin to understand what bothers, what perplexes the mind of Rav Mordechai. This is a classic case of Meleches Hotzah. Mal. Why does he vacillate? Mi Amrin, should we say? Harei Akira Be'isur. Ve'arei Anocha Be'isur. He picks it up in a Rishus HaRavim, and he puts it down in Rishus HaYochid, therefore he's Chayav Odilma. What's it sad to say that he's Patur, came in the Mimakum Turka Asya, because this Amud rises above, it towers above 10 Tfachim. And therefore, what's going to happen is, in order for the object to land by throwing it, it's going to have to arch. There's going to have to be an arch. Right? Any object that you throw and it lands on a place, it's going to have to climb above that object, correct? And now the object is going to climb on top of 10 tefachim. So as far as you're concerned, you started with an Akira Rishus HaYochid, you started with an Akira Rishus HaRamin, you ended with Anochin Rishus HaYochid, but in between, the object flew through a Makom Ptur. And Rabosai, this should really remind us of the old sugya that we learned at the beginning of Perek HaZorik, which is called Kluta Kamisha Unchad Dami, is since the Chefetz comes from Rishus HaYachid through a Makom Ptur, in the case of an Amud which is above 10 Tfachim, so when it climbs above the height of 10 Tfachim Rishus HaRabim, that airspace is called a Makom Ptur, is low, therefore he should not be Chayav. Amalei, so Rav answered Rav Mordechai, Masnisani. Let's derive this from a Mishnah. Which Mishnah? Asa Shaili, so Rav Mordechai comes and he asks Rav Yosef the same question. Amalei, and Rav Yosef answers Masnisani. Derive it from a Mishnah. Asa Shaili Labayit. Everybody gives him the same short answer. Not yay, not nay, but just look it up in the Mishnah. Amalahu, Rav Mordechai says to them, meaning to the three musketeers, so to speak, this trio, Kulchu Bruka De'adode Tfisu. Every country has its own idiomatic phrases, so it's very hard for us culturally to relate to some of the idiomatic phrases that they used back in the time of the Talmud. And it means you all three spit at me the same answer. And you all three are referring to the same proof that would answer my question, but what is this Mishnah? Where is it? Amrulei. So when he asked Rava and Rav Yosef and Abaye, they all answered Rav Mordechai Viatlo Tizbara. And are you unaware of this Mishnah that directly addresses your question? Vasnan, we have a Mishnah back on Daf Tzadites Omen Aleph. Chulya Sabar Vasela, Shem Gvoim Asor Rechoven Arba. Hanoto behem, v'anosein al gabon, chayav. So what do we have here? We have a case of a sela. The sela is 10 tefachim high, right, and 4 tefachim wide. And he's standing on with his feet in Rishus HaRabim. He throws an object onto the sela. No doubt it climbs above 10 tefachim through a Makom Ptur. Lands on the cella, and the Mishnah says he's chayav. Did you not know the Mishnah? Amalahu, Sir Mordechai responds, Dilma masnisin b'machat. Maybe we're talking about a case where it doesn't actually climb above 10 tefachim in the Rishus HaRabim. He throws a needle, which has no basically has no height to it, you know, in and of itself. And it can land on the top of the Sela without climbing above 10 tefachim. So the Gemara asks, wait a minute, what are you talking about? Rav Mordechai, you're making no sense. Machat nami efshar delo medalia purta. Even if you're talking about a machat, there's no way that you can lay it down, place it down on a sela, or take it off the sela, without entering into the height of 10 tefachim. Because again, how's it going to land on the boulder without climbing above 10 tefachim? So Gemara rejects this. What kind of a sela are we talking about? The Islay Mursha. The sela has like a landing, a protrusion. And it's got a Mursha, which is a blita. Where is this blita? It's below 10 tefachim. So it's amazing. The sela itself is a Rishus HaYochid. And anything that juts out from the sela, on this side or on that side, is considered part of the Rishus HaYochid. Let's just think again about what's going on over here. What we're trying to understand is how Rav Mordechai understood our Mishnah in a way that would completely circumvent, obviate the problem of a Makom Patur. So first we try the Machat idea. And the Gemara rejects that idea because even in the case of a Machat, it's got to enter into the airspace above 10 Tefachim. So now the Gemara says that we're talking about a boulder, which again is Rishus HaYochid, it has all the dimensions of Rishus HaYochid, but it has a blita, which we call the Mursha Mitzido, and that is below 10 tefachim. So on both sides, what would you say? Just give me your, so to speak, intuitive, knee-jerk response. Would you say that if he throws an object from Rishus Rav and it lands on this Mursha, he's chayav? Is that Mursha itself part of the Rishus HaYochid? Again, it's attached to the stone. I'm not denying that. But isn't it a separate area unto itself? So this, my friends, is a sugya, which we didn't get up to yet, which is called Chorei Rishus HaYochid. Now, technically, Chorei Rishus HaYochid refers to cavities in the stone. And the status of Chorei Rishus HaYochid, the Gemara employs the concept of bittul, that the holes of Rishus HaYochid don't form or are not given the yichus, the status of a separate independent place. They are bottled, they lose their identity, and they are part of the Rishus HaYochid. That's called Chorei Rishus HaYochid. This becomes very relevant in the case of a kosel. So let's say, for example, I'm walking down a major highway, and you have a house, and there's a kosel that surrounds your house. There are crevices and cracks in the kosel, and I take an object and I put it, lay it down in those cracks, or one of those cracks. That's called Chorei Rishus HaYochid. And the halach of Chorei Rishus HaYochid is that they're bottled to the Rishus HaYochid. So he takes this machat, and he lays it down on this blita, this protrusion, which is located below 10 tefachim, and that blita, which we in the Gemara calls a Mursha, is batel to the Rishus HaYachid, meaning to the Sela. Now again, I would add the following comment. If that Blita itself would be so significant in size, let's say, for example, it would be 4 Tfachim in width, then it would be a Makom Ptur. We haven't solved any of our problems. Why do we consider this Blita as part of the Rishus HaYachid? Because we're going to employ the principle of Bittul, which, the precedent of which is called Chorei Rishus HaYachid. Inami, the Gemara answers, offers an alternative answer to interpret our Mishnah in such a way that Rav Mordechai would say that our Mishnah is no proof. Deramya b'charitza, that on the top of this boulder there are crevices and there's a machat, there's a needle that is lying inside one of these crevices on the top of the cella. And let's take the case of Natal Misham, right? Natal Misham means he takes the object from Rishus HaYochid out to the Rishus HaRabin. What he does is he slips the machat through the crevice and holds it in Rishus HaRabin. That machat is not above 10 tfachim, because the top of the cella is 10 tfachim, and the charitza, which is the crevice, is below 10 tfachim, and it's open towards the sides of Rishus HaRabin. So when he slips the machat out from this boulder, and he's holding it now in Rishus HaRabin, he has now completed a Meleches Hotzah. And the reason for that is simply because he has a part of the Rishus HaYochid that's below 10 Tfachim, and that's the part that from which he takes out the machat. So just to make a long story short, Rav Mordechai is sort of insisting that if an object goes through a Makom Ptur, you're not chayev for that. Or you might not be chayev. I mean, he vacillates. The other Amoraim were convinced that going through a Makom Ptur is not a problem. It doesn't in any way undermine the Meleches Hotzah. In a case of Zriko, we're going to look at the Akira, which was in a Rishus HaRabim, let's say, and the Hanochin Rishus HaYochid. The fact that the object in its flight travels through a Rishus Ptur, Makom Ptur, is irrelevant. And that's our Mishnah. But Rav Mordechai, who was not convinced that going through a Makom Ptur will generate a chiyuv for Meleches Hotzah, he therefore reinterpreted the Mishnah in one of two alternative ways where the object did not go through a Makom Ptur. Okay, there are both sides. We're going to stop here. And let's just make a note of where we got up to, because, you know, from one day to the other, it's kind of easy to forget. We're up to Omar Rav Miyasha. We have a brisa that we quoted back on Dav Vav, Hamotzi Michanus, which is Rishus HaYochid, Leflatya, which is Rishus HaRab, Derech Satya, Derech Stav, which is a Carmelis, he's Chayev. So that itself should prove and tip the scale in Rav Mordechai's Sofek, that even though the Chayef is coming from Rishus HaRab and through a Carmelis, he's Chayev. And Tosus Dimaskal O, second Tosus on the page here, raises this question. Furthermore, we have a Gemara back on Daf Tzadi Beis of Hamotzi Masa Rishus HaRabim Lamala Me'asar Tvachim Chayev. So Tosus, therefore, quoting Rav Parat, claims that Rav Mordechai knew that a person who throws an object or carries an object from Rishus HaRabim to Rishus HaYochid through a Makom Ptur is Chayev. His suffix was only with regard to Zrika from Rishus HaRabim to Rishus HaYochid derech Makor Patur. In a case where Loba Chefetz Rishus HaYochid Mikocho. For example, he throws an object up on high and it falls on a stone in a diagonal, which is called an alakson, through the avir of Rishus HaRabim. So when the chefetz hits its highest point in the air, and then it turns downwards, and by law of gravity, right on an angle, balakson, then the malach is completed in a way that's beyond the koach of the zorek, so to speak. The koach, the force, the energy force that was placed into the object by the zorek only reaches that pinnacle. Wherever the object lands afterwards, that's koach kocho. And one would say, and this is what Rav Mordechai was vacillating about, that perhaps if the object doesn't reach a reshus hayochin mikocho, but rather only mikoach kocho, that's how it lands on the cell after it hits that pinnacle and turns downwards, and now it goes through a makom patur, then he's not chayav. In other words, even though koach kocho is considered an asiya, it is considered his action, but nevertheless, here his koach comes from the makom patur, because at what point does it turn the corner, so to speak, from the pinnacle from kocho to kocho? That's in a makom patur above ten tefachim. So even though when you bring an object from a makom patur into a reshus hayochid, that's considered the action of the zorek, but nevertheless, it's not a hemshech of the pula sazrika rishona. That's a new pu'ula that starts from kocho and becomes koach kocho. And that new pu'ula was projected by or from a makom patur. That's the nature of the suffix of Rav Mordechai according to Rabbeinu Parat. Okay then, we'll stop here.